Yo, neighbors. I wasn't sure if I was going to make another episode for this week, but when I went to save my William Cooper Mystery Babylon series episode, I realized it was going to be episode 69. And I didn't want to let that number just float away willy-nilly as it passed. So I thought instead I would make an episode of me babbling a bunch. So I hope that you enjoy this. Hang tight, okay? It's good and you're gonna like it. We're gonna talk about happiness. Think about happiness. What does happiness mean to you? What are we exactly striving for when we say we just want to be happy? What does it mean? Does it mean that one day we'll reach the pinnacle of feeling and never feel sad again? Will we just get to this point where everything we do makes us smile and we feel no pain? Seems kind of ridiculous when you actually say the words and put it in that context, but I think that is the idea that we all have when we say, we're just trying to be happy. I'm just trying to do this certain thing and then I'll be happy. I'm gonna find happiness. You know? Does that make sense? So what is happiness? I've been thinking a lot about happiness lately. I think because I've been making huge changes in my life and with the kind of goal of making it happier or like achieving more happiness. But with it has come such dramatic lows as I go through the journey of reaching it that I realize that like there's no just like, it's not a mountain we climb where we reach the peak and then we're at happiness and that's it. That's never the case. And being a happy person doesn't mean always being happy. It's impossible. It's ridiculous. Like I consider my life very happy, but since practicing sitting in my feelings when I feel them, and actually considering what I'm feeling and like going deep into it, I realized the lows are still low. Things happen in my life where I can have like a day or a half day where I feel just as low as when I was in months of depressions in my 20s, like when I was like my lowest of my life, just the lows extended for longer periods during that time. And so it felt all encompassing, but I can still get that low pretty quick too and pretty easy. And that can be wallowing in my self-pity pretty fast, as happy as I think my life is or see my life or as much happiness as I have on the day to day, the lows can still come at me. Life has contrast of suffering, or we wouldn't know happiness when we found it. Perpetual happiness is impossible, and yet it's what we're all constantly striving to attain. But even at our happiest moments, we hold a pit of suffering within, because a part of us knows that happiness ebbs and flows like waves in the ocean. And if we are creating a massive wave of happiness, there's no permanence in it. Eventually, life will deliver suffering to our doorstep, and there's no stopping its arrival. Which makes me think, would we attain more thorough happiness if we accepted that a low is coming and that it's okay, instead of resisting the low that was inevitable? Like, is it that our highs are so fleeting that they slip through our fingers like fog? Or do we make a mistake equating happiness with ease? Is it that we need things to be easy to find joy in that moment? Or is this just another way we are setting ourselves up for disappointment? And isn't the act of being disappointed harvested from expectations instead of allowing? We're expecting. That's where we find disappointment. If we allow the lows to come, and we maybe welcome them, if we can find a way to do that, wouldn't it make the highs feel more deep within us, or more satisfying to be in? So, I maybe brought this up a couple times, but I've been listening to these near-death experience stories lately. And today I heard someone say that a major revelation they gained from crossing over briefly was to really be happy. You have to learn how to suffer joyfully. And I thought quite a bit about what that actually means. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. We should cultivate the ability to tolerate the ups and downs of life without being overwhelmed by them, just like the Gita says. This requires a sense of detachment, deep understanding that everything in life is temporary and fleeting. Happiness is not a mountain you climb. Happiness is the rhythm of life. It's what we came here to experience. Detachment and surrender over the outcome and variables of our life path is what will bring us the peace of deep contentment. A surrendering to the divine plan. Although we literally have no control over these things, the act of surrendering to the outcome is somehow terrifying. But whenever I have like resistance in me or feel like I'm at a wall emotionally or mentally or like in this physical world, some kind of wall, a hurdle I feel like I can't overcome, and I do a meditation or I get like still with myself and really ask myself, what's the best way? I always see the river. The river flows. You can push things out into it. You can try to stop the water from flowing. You could build a dam, but eventually the levee will fill. and the water will flow over. The river flows no matter what, and the river is the energetic flow of our experience here. Resistance doesn't stop the flow. It only causes you turmoil. The ease is with letting it flow and going with it the way that it wants to carry you. The Gita also says something else that I find very fitting here. It says, "You have the right to perform your prescribed duties, but you are not entitled to the fruits of your actions. Be steadfast to the performance of your duty, Arjuna, abandoning attachment to success or failure. Seek refuge in divine knowledge and insight, Arjuna, and discard reward-seeking actions that are certainly inferior to work performed with intellect established in divine knowledge. Miserly are those who seek to enjoy the fruits of their work." Just like I said before about disappointment, it comes with the expectation of our service having a reward for self, which is usually the idea of happiness in some form or another. If we can serve and find joy in the service, it's joy that's the real goal. Because we can find joy in suffering, we can find joy in service, and we can find joy in everyday moments. Whereas sometimes in these things, happiness is unattainable, or the idea we have in the context that we put happiness in is unattainable. And what makes joy less than happiness? Nothing. Joy and suffering, I think, should be the goal over happiness. Or to reframe our idea of happiness to not be just like the peak of the mountain, to find happiness in everyday service. So in that verse from the Gita, there are two aspects at play. Number one, the external activity we do, the service we perform, or the action we take. And number two, our internal attitude towards it. When we understand that the effort is in our hands, not the results, we can transform our inner state of being. We can serve with service being the gift, finding joy in service, and learn to suffer joyfully. Because, you know, there is no way to stop suffering. I think it's the point of this realm. I think we learn from the suffering. It can beat us, or we can persevere and find joy. There's no way to stop suffering, but there is a way to always be serving the highest good, making ourselves a vessel for divine service. And in that way, we release expectations of the outcome, negating disappointment, finding happiness without needing to find ease, finding happiness in the work and hardship, letting go of control and trusting the divine plan. What other way is there? We can't control much. So when we're stressing ourselves over controlling circumstances and outcomes, we are suffering needlessly, full of resistance and full of expectations. This idea is polished off in the Gita when Krishna says to Arjuna in chapter 2, verse 50, "One who prudently practices the science of work without attachment can get rid of both good and bad reactions in this life itself. Therefore, strive for yoga, which is the art of working skillfully in proper consciousness." What he's saying here is it's in the mind. It's in self. You can choose how you experience each moment, regardless of what is happening externally in the moment. You cannot control the outcome. You can control releasing expectations for the outcome and finding joy in the service and in the work. And I think that is happiness. I think that happiness is a choice. Joy is a choice. It's not the absence of suffering. There is no such thing as the absence of suffering. And honestly, I think that's where people make a huge mistake, is they strive their whole life to find ways to remove suffering around them. And so when people work really hard and become multimillionaires and fill their life with ease, they think that that will equate to happiness because they've removed suffering. They have someone doing all the things they've seen as suffering for them. But suffering will find you anyway. And when you realize that you've worked so hard and you've climbed this mountain and you've reached the peak to a place where you've removed all suffering that you perceived in your life, and you do not find happiness at the peak, I think there's room there for very deep lows. Because I think the path that you take when you do it that way has led you astray, and so far astray, and so deep into what you thought would bring you the best feeling that you find the worst feeling. And that's how come I think sometimes people appear to have it all, and they're actually in the darkest place a human can be, to the point where they don't want to be on this plane anymore, and they remove themselves from the experience of life. And it's the same reason why you can find people that have absolutely nothing and have no riches to show for, and no material items that they can have themselves surrounded with, no ease in their lives. They're working hard and they're appearing to be suffering in that way. And they are some of the most joyful people you can ever come across. And they have so much value in every moment of their life because their perception is completely different. And they don't see happiness as a mountain. They see it as a moment, as a thought, as a feeling that comes from within. And sometimes we can find deep lows when we're doing things that are going to make us have more hugs. The act of shifting our life in extreme ways and entering unknown spaces in our hearts or physical life, trying new things that are completely different from what we know and where our comfort is, can bring us very deep lows and make us question everything we are trying to do or strive for or be. But it's sort of like a small test. And if you trust yourself and you trust your heart and you find joy, even when you feel like giving up because of the suffering, you find great rewards on the other side. So I want you guys to think about that. Think about the art of suffering joyfully and what that can bring you. There's no reason to break your own heart every day with the expectation when you could just find joy in each moment. In any place, in any circumstance. If you're listening to this right now, you have a lot of freedom and you have a lot of resources available to you and you have a lot of things to be joyful for. And you could say that maybe you're not happy or one day you're going to be happy, but look in the mirror. There's happiness in moments right now. There's joy right now. Even the darkest times, you can see a little light. And yeah, I just want you guys to transcend the idea that happiness is a hard thing to attain. Or that it's a permanent state once you attain it. Because I don't think either of those things are true. And maybe if that's too hard to allow that feeling in, start thinking about joy instead of happiness. And start thinking about joyful moments, joyful thoughts. Joy in suffering, joy in work, joy in our labor and in our service to others. And I think when you reframe that, you'll find less resistance and less of a feeling of being stuck in darkness once you're there, and less of a feeling of your happiness being temporary once you're there, or the dread of it falling away when you're in a high. And yeah, this is episode 69, and I'm gonna add a little clip to the end of this, and I hope you guys enjoyed being with me today. I know I have been a little elusive this summer, but I've been joyfully working hard to expand my horizons in my life. And so I hope it starts to be reflected in my work and what I bring to you and the evolution of the show. And I love you guys for listening every week and coming back even when I have to take short breaks. This platform and this space where I can share has just been so rewarding to me, and I'm so thankful that anyone at all even listens. And so I love you guys, and I'll see you next week. I found a very special recording of a lecture where Alan Watts introduces the concepts from the Bhagavad Gita. And so I hope you guys really enjoy this. And I think it will tie together with what I was talking about. And I hope it encourages you to read the Gita for yourself, because it is a very valuable text. And I think everyone should read it. Yeah. And of course, we always love Alan Watts. So here it is.
In 1925, Mahatma Gandhi wrote the following words: I find a solace in the Bhagavad Gita that I miss even in the Sermon on the Mount. When disappointment stares me in the face, and all alone I see not one ray of light, I go back to the Bhagavad Gita. I find a verse here and a verse there, and I immediately begin to smile in the midst of overwhelming tragedies. And my life has been full of external tragedies. And if they have left no visible, no indelible scar on me, I owe it all to the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. In this passage that I've just quoted to you, Mahatma Gandhi was referring to what is perhaps the most famous of all the spiritual classics of India, the Bhagavad Gita, or Bhagavad the Lord Gita Song, the Song of the Lord. It is spelled Bhagavad, Bhagavad, Gita, Gita, the Song of the Lord. The Lord in this case being Sri Krishna, who in Hindu mythology is regarded as an incarnation, an embodiment, in the Sanskrit language, an avatar of Vishnu, the Supreme Lord, the personification of the ultimate reality underlying this universe. The Bhagavad Gita was probably compiled about the 5th century BC, and it forms a part of a great epic called the Mahabharata. It's attributed to a sage by the name of Vyasa and contains a complete epitome of the whole central doctrine of Hinduism known as the Vedanta. It's a very fascinating and to us puzzling fact that Gandhi, preeminently the man of non-violence in modern times, was so devoted to this book. Because the scene with which the book opens is a battlefield, the field of Kuru, where a young prince by the name of Arjuna is riding in his chariot, and Sri Krishna, the incarnation of Vishnu, is his charioteer. As the opposing armies face each other, and the battle is about to begin, and Arjuna is faint in heart, oppressed with the senselessness of this struggle and of internecine warfare. And the Gita says in the first chapter, he was overcome with great compassion and uttered this in sadness: when I see my own people arrayed and eager for fight, O Krishna, my limbs quail, my mouth goes dry, my body shakes and my hair stands on end. And I see evil omens, O Krishna, nor do I foresee any good by slaying my own people in the fight. I do not long for victory, O Krishna, nor kingdom nor pleasures. Of what use is kingdom to us, O Krishna, or enjoyment, or even life? And having spoken thus on the field of battle, Arjuna sank down on the seat of his chariot, casting away his bow and arrow, his spirit overwhelmed by sorrow. And to this complaint, his charioteer, the Lord Krishna, replies, Whence has come to thee this stain, this dejection of spirit in this hour of crisis? It is unknown to men of noble mind. Yield not to this unmanliness, O Arjuna, for it does not become thee. Cast off this petty faint-heartedness, and arise, O oppressor of the foes. And to give point to his words, Krishna goes on, Thou grievest for those for whom thou shouldst not grieve, and yet thou speakest words about wisdom. Wise men do not grieve for the dead, nor for the living. Never was there a time when I was not, nor thou, nor these lords of men, nor will there ever be a time hereafter when we shall cease to be. As the soul passes in this body through childhood, youth, and age, even so is its taking of another body. The sage is not perplexed by this. Heat and cold, pleasure and pain come and go and do not last forever. These learn to endure. The man who is not troubled by these, O chief of men, who remains the same in pain and pleasure, who is wise, makes himself fit for eternal life. Of the non-existent, there is no coming to be. Of the existent, there is no ceasing to be. The conclusion about these two has been perceived by the seers of truth. Know thou that that by which all this is pervaded is indestructible. Of this immutable being, no one can bring about the destruction. It is said that these bodies of the eternal embodied, which is indestructible and incomprehensible, come to an end. Therefore fight, O Arjuna. He who thinks that this slays, and he who thinks that this is slain, both of them fail to perceive the truth. This one neither slays nor is slain. He is never born, nor does he die at any time. Nor having come to be, does he again cease to be. He is unborn, eternal, permanent, and primeval. He is not slain when the body is slain. Now, it's obvious, I think, to those of you who have listened to any other of these programs, what Sri Krishna is talking about here. When I was talking to you about the Upanishads, I explained at several points the fundamental doctrine of the Hindus. And that is that the innermost reality of man is not quite what we who have been brought up in a Christian tradition call the soul. We have an inherited teaching, of course, of an immortal and individual soul, which is the root principle of every human being. But in the Hindu doctrines, the soul is not individual. The soul is supra-individual, or, as they would say in their technical language, the Atman, the soul, or self. Self is really a better translation than soul. The Atman is identical with Brahman. And Brahman is the name which they use for the ultimate reality which underlies this whole universe. Now, I don't want you to think of Brahman as a sort of vast blob of perfectly transparent jello which penetrates the whole world. I think that's what many people imagine when they hear this kind of thing. The whole point of the Brahman idea is missed. When you form any image of it in your mind at all, even jello, even empty space or boundless light, Brahman is what we ourselves really are, what this whole universe is fundamentally and actually. There is no way of thinking about, of imagining that. For the very simple reason that as water cannot rise higher than its own level, thought cannot think what is higher than thinking. It cannot conceive the mind which thinks, and still less the power which generates the mind. Our symbols for, our ideas about this supreme reality are vaguish and voidish. Not at all because that reality is vague and void, but because thought and imagination are annihilated in trying to grasp it. The essential teaching which the Gita is trying to convey is that the real center and soul, the basic reality of you and I, is not the superficial consciousness which we ordinarily call myself. What we are fundamentally is this unthinkable source of life and existence named Brahman the Expansive. Nor must we confuse this unthinkable center of our lives with a sort of inert stuff, a so-called blind force. For one doesn't derive life and consciousness, feeling and reason from mere stuff, as if the dead were able to give birth to the living. You know, this notion of blind force as the ultimate reality, which has been popularized by a facile scientism, is merely the result of the fact that when the human mind gets out of its depth, it drowns and vomits up a lot of dead ideas. And so Sri Krishna goes on. He who knows that it is indestructible and eternal, uncreated and unchanging, how can such a person slay anyone, O Arjuna, or cause anyone to slay? Just as a person casts off worn-out garments and puts on others that are new, even so does the embodied soul cast off worn-out bodies and take on others that are new. Weapons do not cleave this self. Fire does not burn him. Waters do not make him wet, nor does the wind make him dry. He is uncleavable, he cannot be burned. He can neither be wetted nor dried. He is eternal, all-pervading, unchanging and immovable. He is the same forever. He is said to be manifest, unmanifest, unthinkable and unchanging. Therefore, knowing him as such, thou shouldst not grieve. Even if thou thinkest that the self is perpetually born and perpetually dies, even then, O mighty armed, thou shouldst not grieve. For to the one that is born, death is certain, and certain is birth for the one that has died. Therefore, for what is unavoidable, thou shouldst not grieve. Perhaps that last passage needs a little bit of interpretation. For to one that is born, death is certain, is a statement, of course, which is obvious enough. But not so obvious to us is, and certain is birth for the one that has died. I should try to explain this a little bit, because it's a passage expressive of what is called in India the doctrine of rebirth or reincarnation. If you will think for a moment of what you were before you were born, you will come to the rather puzzling conclusion that you before you were born are impossible to think about. Before you were conceived by your father and mother in the womb, you can't remember anything. You don't even remember darkness, not even a blank. Your background, your past history, right at its beginning, seems to be a state of complete annihilation of your ego, of your personality. And yet, oddly enough, here you are. After you die, you may presumably go again into a state which we can imagine only as complete annihilation, of complete nothingness. And if so, you will, won't you, be in the same sort of condition as you were before you were born. You came out of that state, though. Should you be afraid to return to it? This is perhaps a rather elementary way of expressing the Hindu doctrine of rebirth. But I don't want to give the impression that the Hindu doctrine is, as it is imagined to be by many people in the West, a doctrine of the reappearance again and again in this life of an individual soul. I think it is true to say that according to the strict doctrine of the Vedanta, there is not an individual soul which passes from life to life. The one who transmigrates is precisely this Atman or Brahman. And this is why we have to imagine the state before birth and after death as blank annihilation. Because thought is annihilated in trying to grasp the reality which lies deeper than thinking. The finger that struggles to touch its own tip finds only the empty air. And so Krishna goes on. The dweller in the body of everyone, O Arjuna, is eternal and can never be slain. Therefore thou shouldst not grieve for any creature. Further, having regard for thine own duty, thou shouldst not falter. There exists no greater good for a kshatriya than a war enjoined by duty. I think it is just at this point that we puzzle about this book in relation to Mahatma Gandhi. Let me explain the passage that I've just read. A kshatriya is a member of one of the three great castes of Hindu society, those castes being respectively Brahmana, which is the priestly caste, the sacerdotium, Kshatriya, the caste of warriors and rulers, Vaishya, the caste of merchants. And they're roughly equivalent to the Lords Spiritual, the Lords Temporal, and the Commons of medieval European society. And each caste has its proper duty in life, which in Sanskrit is Svadharma. And this is the phrase which Krishna uses here when he says, having regard for thine own duty, for thine own svadharma. Sva, self, dharma, function. Or svadharma is probably best translated into English as vocation. The kshatriya is one who has a vocation to fight. That's his job. Whereas a Brahmin, or more particularly, one who has gone beyond caste altogether, one who in India is called a sannyasin, corresponding in the medieval West to the monks and hermits, those who have gone outside society, they do not have the vocation or the duty of fighting. I think the clue to the problem of the Gita, especially in relation to that great non-violent man, Gandhi, is this. Primarily, Arjuna's objection to taking part in war is a sentimental one. He is unwilling to fight in the battle because of his depressed emotions in regard to slaying his kinsman, or, we would say, in regard to slaying one's fellow man. If one would be a pacifist because one is merely squeamish and is the kind of person of whom one would say, well, he couldn't even hurt a fly, then surely there is something phony about such pacifism because it is sentimental. This does seem to be Arjuna's objection. And this is why Krishna says, in effect, your objection to slaying is a fear of slaying, a squeamishness to slay. And because of this, you do not have a genuine objection to slaying. If you refrain from taking part in battle because you are frightened of so doing, or because you are sentimental, You are not the kind of person who really has a right to abstain from battle. Now, why does he say this? The reason is that to the Hindu mind, one who abstains from what might be an evil action through fear has not really liberated himself from evil. Krishna would say that so long as our conduct is motivated by fear on the one hand, or by desire on the other, we are incapable of performing a truly moral action. Only those actions are truly moral which are unmotivated. Because if you are motivated to do good by fear, your good may, under other circumstances, be evil. This is the case with Arjuna. He wants to refrain from war for the same reason for which many other people would engage in war. Many people engage in war because they're afraid, and not at all because they hate the world's situation at the present time. Might be said to be a situation of mutual fear, where the only reason why someone might start a war would be for fear of the other side starting it first. After all, we all know now that modern warfare is something in which neither side wins. It is then fear more than anything else. Fear that the other fellow should send the bombs over first is what starts a war. And thus, you see, fear is no deterrent to war at all. A person whose reluctance to fight is based on fear or squeamishness does not, then, in Krishna's view, have the right to renounce it. And you see here, the view is one which would probably commend itself to a man like Gandhi. Because you could turn it round in the other way and say that a person who has to take the step of being a non-violent man, a man of peace, a pacifist, he would have his vocation and his duty to do in exactly the same way as the kshatriya, the warrior. He must not be non-violent on sentimental grounds, but rather because he sees it as his svadharma, that is to say, his vocation in life. And so a moment later, Krishna formulates the principle of action. He says, "Therefore arise, O son of Kunti, Arjuna, resolved on battle, treating alike pleasure and pain, gain and loss, victory and defeat. To action alone hast thou a right, never at all to its fruits. Let not the fruits of action be thy motive, neither let there be in thee any attachment to inaction. Fixed in yoga, that is to say, in union with the principle, with the self, do thy work, O winner of wealth, abandoning attachment, with an even mind in success and failure, for evenness of mind is called yoga. One who has yoked his intelligence with the divine casts away even here both good and evil. Therefore strive for yoga. Yoga is skill in action." The principle, you see, which he enunciates is to act without attachment to the fruits of action, to do what you have to do without seeking either evil or good from it. Now, this is simply another way of saying to act without motive. It seems, of course, from our point of view, impossible that a human being should act without motive. In our Western way of thinking about ethics, we judge the quality of an action by the quality of the motive. And the whole notion of an action without a motive at all seems to be extraordinarily foreign to us. But as a matter of fact, if there is no such thing as an action without motive, there is no such thing as a free or moral action. Because so long as we have a motive, our actions are not actions, they're simply reactions. Surely it's obvious that our motives are determined by our conditioning, by our environment, our heredity, our social structure. They give us motives, and these motives of the past determine the way in which we act. Now, if my motive for doing good is for the sake of some sort of a reward, whether it's in the ancient sense of going to heaven or the modern sense of being a real person or a regular guy, or whether it's a fear in the ancient sense of going to hell or in the modern sense of being a cad, I act motivatedly. And therefore the things which I do by way of moral action are not actually free. If, as we in the West have rather inconsistently but nevertheless rightly insisted, a moral man must be a free man, a free man must be an unmotivated man. In Western Christianity, it has always been thought that there is only one unmotivated being, and this would be God. In the words of the ancient hymn in the Catholic breviary, God is creation's secret force, thyself unmoved, all motion's source. God, then, would be the one who would act without motive, who would act spontaneously from himself without having to be pushed around. The point, you see, of the Hindu teaching is that in reality, each one of us is that unmoved one, that unmotivated one. The root and ground of our soul and mind is the same as the root and ground of this whole universe. Therefore, one in whom this is fully realized can act in an unmotivated way. In studying the philosophy of the Hindus, we have to get used to the idea that it's really an illusion to suppose that every event is motivated, determined, or caused by the past. What they call karma, or causation by the past, is in fact maya, or unreality. For in the Hindu philosophy, the present of the universe, or the eternal now of the universe, is not the consequence of its past, but rather the past is always the consequence of the present, of the eternal now. It trails behind it like the wake of a ship. It does not stand before it and push it. And thus, it is through the realization that he is that eternal now, not his past, that Arjuna is able to act in a free way, in an unmotivated way, and thus go into battle, not because he is moved to fight by hate, by squeamishness or fear, but because he carries out his appointed place in a society in which it's his vocation to be a warrior. We may think it regrettable that societies exist in which there is a vocation to be a warrior, but let's not be sentimental in this respect also. Because every one of us is unable to live at all without killing something. Some of us would like to rule out altogether the killing of our fellow men. But you see, in the Hindu view of life, there isn't this rigid distinction between man on the one hand and animals and plants on the other, which exists for us in the West. Therefore, there are times in the Hindu view when killing is an unavoidable condition of being alive. And this is one of the problems which the Gita sets itself to solve. I've read these selections from the translation of the Bhagavad Gita, that's spelled Bhagavad hyphen Gita, translated by Dr. S. Radhakrishnan, Radhakrishnan, As you may know, Dr. Radhakrishnan is the Vice President of India. The translation is published by Harper and Brothers of New York. It is one of the best of the many translations that I know, and is provided throughout with an excellent commentary. The strange